You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 389 is something like, how do wealth and power affect people? And we're continuing our treatment of the spirit chapter of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, now covering sections 511 through 537 in that subsection called Self-Alienated Spirit, period, culture, period. We'll be finishing up the subsection within that called Culture and Its Realm of Actuality. For more information about the text and the podcast, please see partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintzemeyer, happy to give the monarch my name, if he can spell it, in Madison, Wisconsin.
And this is Seth Paskin, a vagabond parasite in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwyn, outwardly the reverse of what I am for myself in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
All right, so our last episode, when we were already talking about culture, we had sort of gotten the idea that when you emerge as an I, as a recognized person, well, what are you? How do people recognize that you are a person? Culture offers these roles that you can step into. And toward the end of that, we are getting into the distinction between power. So, you know, the power of the state. So you could identify by, you know, per our group psychology episodes, by sort of putting your selfhood into saying, I'm a Trumpy, I'm doing service for your, so I'm a good citizen. That's one way of asserting power, by sort of giving up your personal power to share in this group power. Or you could emphasize wealth, right? How much do I personally have my self-interest, and that these things are kind of at war as dueling ideals in the state. Yeah. So what's the next step here, if we want to summarize?
What section did we stop at?
510 or 509, maybe?
Yeah, we got toward the end. I think the last thing we said anything about are 508 and 509, right? So technically, we're starting at 511, but I did feel like it would be really nice. 508 throws in that thing about language, which we didn't really discuss enough, and throws in something about time.
Yeah, so it gives us some insight into how we become self-conscious, right? So we produce ourselves as alienated in part in language, or he says it takes place in language. And language is what allows us to exist for others. So in a way, it's a tool of recognition. And as we remember, in a way, we're constituted by recognition. We internalize the recognition of others to become self-conscious, to become what we are. And by the way, I've been going back through via another commentary and looking at perception, and all of this is in parallel, right? Perceptual objects become what they are by internalizing the standpoint of other objects for which they are other. So Hegel says they become other to themselves. They become self-alienated. And we ourselves must become self-alienated to become self-conscious. We must integrate the perspective of the other. In 508, we come to exist for others and to be perceived by them as conscious beings through language. And he says that, you know, facial expressions and body language are not enough. But in doing so, we become universal to others in the same way that language makes everything universal. So, right, even though this is a universal. So our individuality kind of vanishes in that moment that we are revealed to the other.
There's a section, yeah, this is basically that speech or languages used to prompt action, and now it is an action. Like, it is the authoritative action of the self. That's really interesting. I think it's hard. I thought about this while we were, so I had a kind of funny experience this weekend. I've been doing talks at my father's retirement, my parents' retirement community, on philosophical topics. And I was going to talk to them about consciousness and self-consciousness, you know, and sort of like the mysteries thereof. And my dad, who usually picks up what I'm trying to lay down pretty easily, was really struggling because I was kind of, I think I'm infected with Hegelian sensibilities trying to explain self-consciousness to a retired engineer. It was a little hard, but the way that Hegel talks about the emergence of language in culture at this point, and the assumptions we have to make about what was happening prior to this point, how did language function in the Greek, in the ethical society, right? Spirit as ethics, as ethical it's hard for us to picture that way. It's hard for us to think that way, that things just weren't always the way they are for us right now in terms of the way culture functions, the way language functions, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry, it was just a little side note I just kept coming up with as I read this.
Yeah, I think I overstated this point last time because I thought he was just sort of throwing in, and here is where language is introduced in the whole book. But I'm not sure that that's the case. It's just that language, which might have just been around for other purposes, is used in this important way to express the I, that it would not be possible for us to have a self-image if we didn't have language. That doesn't mean that language emerges at the same time as self-image.
Well, yeah, he's, you know, it's not a historical moment, right? Obviously, language has existed and it's existed for this function. He's highlighting it right now because it's going to be important in the construction of the monarch, right? The absolute monarch, Louis XIV, ultimately, through flattery. So he wants to remind us of this important role of language in producing the other and or producing ourselves, and then describe specific modes of language like flattery and what they do, how they can give state power and individual existence and individual will via flattery.
So, right. This is going to be a specific case of this general way that language interacts with identity. Let me just read the end of 508 here. This is the top of page 309. Because here's another thing that I kind of want to overstate is he introducing temporality here for the first time? It's not really clear to me. The I that utters itself is heard or perceived. It is an infection in which it has immediately passed into unity with those for whom it is real existence, and it is universal self-consciousness. So language is the thing, right? We talked about this for reason. Wes and I did a close reads on this. It provides the glue that allows us all to think more or less in a group mind, right? We're all using the same language. That is perceived or heard means that its real existence dies away. This, its otherness, has been taken back into itself, and its real existence is just this. That is a self-conscious now as a real existence. It is not a real existence. And through this vanishing, it is a real existence. This vanishing is thus itself at once its abiding. It is its own knowing of itself, and its knowing of itself as a self that is passed over into another self that has been perceived and is universal.
So in Sense Certainty, he talks about the now as well. And it's not just the this, but sure. The now. And so if you go back, you'll see that this is very reminiscent of Sense Certainty, except that he's doing it for the I. And the idea is, I think that we, you know, I, Wes, can reveal myself in a sense and my particularity to you through language. And he says above, right, action and physiognomic expression are not enough. Action I take to involve body language. But in doing so, right, language is just universal, and the word I is a universal. So to reveal myself that way is to disappear in my particularity and vanish, but also to become real, ironically, but just via the universal.
Yeah, there's work I feel like I'm going to end up having to do to parse out a number of these Hegelian, like, substance actuality. I think we talked about this last time. It's just like, I know that there's very technical usages, but, and I'm wondering if he's consistent. But language plays a special role here. So prior to this moment, the work of the individual to identify, the alienation that allows the individual to become self-conscious in the previous movement that we were talking about, so the Roman wealth and the state and so forth, only gets that self-consciousness as what he calls a universal individuality. So you're alienated, which is what's necessary, right? For any form of self-conscious requires a type of alienation, I think. Because you're alienated against this thing that it has actuality, but not substance or something like that. Wealth is, it's a real thing. It actually exists, but it isn't a thing of the right sort that you're going to need for true self-consciousness. So it doesn't have the kind of substance you're looking for, right?
It is essenceless, yes.
Yeah. So what happens here at this movement is we've moved beyond the noble and the ignoble consciousness around wealth and the state, right? And now we're getting to, as Wes said, the monarch, and you start talking about, well, what is the currency? What is the way in which an individual is going to relate themselves to this alienated thing in order to become self-conscious or to try to become self-conscious? Well, it's going to be flattery, right? It's going to be language, because it's not about money, buying and selling things, or exercise of power, which is a different thing. It's like the whole function of culture, civil society, at least in this courtly state, is through discourse. So flattery, of course, is one way, but he uses other examples than you can imagine. But the whole point is you move to a mechanism where individuals are trying to find self-worth, not by accumulating and spending wealth. And you don't have to talk to somebody to buy them food or to give them, you know, alms or what have you. And so it makes sense in it, to me anyway, what he means when he's saying that language is the deed, so to speak. Language is the thing, because that's the currency of the court. That's the currency of culture. And I assume that it remains in that place as we get further along.
Well, just language is the deed in that it is a performative, right? It is, I'm aligning myself. I'm giving praise to the monarch. And in that way, I'm sort of putting myself in the monarch. So, but language is also the thing that hangs around. You, that label, as you know, labels are eternal. Not that it always applies to you, but just whenever you enter the world of ideas, you're no longer in the world of actions and change. So it seems like language is the transition that you get nailed down. Like, you're not merely, I mean, what you are really in yourself is this ever-changing spiritual thing. But as soon as, okay, now Seth is a person of a certain status and profession in this society, then now he has this label that is a static thing. So through these actions that are in time, you create something that is atemporal, right? That's what makes it substantial, I think. Wes, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking we should probably move on here.
Yes.
I mean, he tells us in 509 that language is going to bridge the gap. It's going to be one of his mediators, right? It's going to be the middle term. And it's going to bridge the gap specifically between state power and the noble consciousness. And in 510, he foreshadows how this is going to work, where we get basically this split into between obedience and noble consciousness and then self-centeredness in state power, as state power becomes essentially the universal monarch and a self with a will and the power of decision, but it's going to be served by obedience. And that's going to happen in 511, he tells us, when we make this transition from service, right? The prior to now, it's been actual, like, you know, lords and vassals serving the Lord in various ways to kind of sort of construct the Lord. But now we're going to construct a single universal monarch, and we're going to do that by leaving service behind and getting into flattery. And in 511, that raises state power into the status of an unlimited monarch with self-consciousness, with individuality. And in a way, he gives us kind of this metaphorical, well, who knows what he means metaphorically and literally, but he gives us this idea that the nobles divest themselves of their selfhood in a way and give that function over to the monarch. It's like he collects their selfhood. This is very reminiscent, right, of the Roman phase, where the selfhood of all the Roman subjects gets collected into the emperor, right? So it's another, you know, one of these recapitulations where it's happening now with nobles and the monarch.
Yeah. So if we just, before we, I know we're already immersed, but to kind of sum up what we're talking about for the rest of this 2 hours, I think it is that this subjugation of the self to the central authority, you know, you try to make it complete, but it's never completely complete, right? You retain, the nobles retain some sense of their self, right? Their spiritual self, right? Something that can't be, just like we were saying, you know, you become something substantial to other people by becoming a lawyer, a doctor, whatever it is, you know, a podcaster. But yet there's always some part of you, you know, the part that the existentialist would emphasize, that cannot be solidified into a social thing. So it ends up that you've become so self-alienated, right? You've thrown yourself and just put all your chips into this social project, you know, that's really something that is not you. And so that sense of alienation, you end up with a sense, you know, thinking that you are one of the nobles in this situation. You end up with such a sense of a disrupted, destroyed self that out of that comes something authentic. So that's going to be, you know, where he's eventually going to go with this.
And the monarch here is, he ends up calling him, this is on page 311, he is a unique atom that cannot impart any of his essential nature. This name is thus the reflection into itself, or the actuality which the universal power has in its own self. Through the name, the power is the monarch. Yeah, so this sounds very much like role construction, right? It's like, right, he only has, when we put someone in a role of authority, they only have that role by virtue of being recognized as such. And it often just goes along with the name. Oh, are you a doctor? Okay, you're a doctor. That's your title. So go ahead and inspect me and maybe open me up and do surgery or whatever. You have the power. But the name itself doesn't disclose to me anything about your essential nature, right? It's just a nature that's been given to you by virtue of being named that. Now, you know, one could say, well, the doctor actually has certain skills and blah, blah, blah. But in this case, especially, what does a monarch have but, you know, having been born into a certain bloodline? But anyway, this idea of a unique atom that can't impart its essential nature, I think is reminiscent of 508, in which we can't truly impart our individuality through language, even though that's the only tool we have for imparting ourselves to others. But in this case, this is what actualizes power, as he puts it.
Yes. I think I would emphasize, rather than the bloodline thing, which, you know, can be different in different societies, and maybe there wasn't the bloodline. It's the king is whoever everybody says is the king. That's the whole secret of power, right? Is that it's a social construction in the most raw sense.
Yeah, it's a genuine social construction, unlike gender. It's like money, the way money is money by virtue of social agreement. The king is the king by virtue of social agreement. And yeah, it's interesting. He calls this the heroism of flattery. It's a very interesting way to put it. And I suppose the heroism is just the self-sacrifice involved, right? Giving up one's selfhood to another.
Well, and it mirrors the heroism in the previous state of going to war. So it's a form of self-sacrifice, because this obviously, you know, on Hegel's view, this all kind of has to take place in some way, shape, or form. So we need people to sacrifice themselves in order for the appropriate cultural construct to come into play so that they can then be alienated by it. Like, in other words, for this whole process that he's been describing, that we've spent 14 years talking about, it has to move forward. For it to move forward, there has to be some kind of tension that ultimately is going to break. And it also means that practically, you know, sort of like metaphorically, or at least narratively, he's talking about spirit and self-consciousness and this kind of like world historical kind of movement. But, you know, the reality is there's a way of talking where you could say, spirit needs individuals to sacrifice. It needs them to be alienated in order for them to recognize. They have to try to find themselves in this thing that they are alienated from, or they have to reconcile their alienation in order to realize that it's not going to work and for things to move forward. So he does use value terms and, you know, normative descriptions frequently that seem very weird. He talks about things being bad where you would think they would be good. He talks about things being good.
Well, yeah, we've seen those reversals, those dialectical reversals between good and bad.
Yeah, that's going to be part of what makes the self feel so broken down. Not just that you've given your whole self into the state or something like that, but that you recognized, you know, as we get toward the end of the part that we read for today, he talks about these witty people that can just, they grasp the absurdity of the situation, that these terms that we apply, good or bad, are really not universal terms, but can be inverted in very practical ways. You know, when everybody is just using flattering Trump, does the word good that is used even mean anything anymore? Because again, it's a performative. It's not actually let us consider the Platonic category of the good. Does Trump fit into that? Yes, it is that it's not that kind of judgment. It is a affirmation. So that goes against our idea that language should be eternal in some way and not be reversible such that good becomes bad and bad becomes good, sort of depending on what team you're on.
Yeah, we saw good and bad reversing themselves in, you know, between, because we get state power versus individuality and being for self, and each can be thought of as good. Just like, right, there's the common good and then there's the individual good. And each can be thought of as good relative to one another or bad, right? Because it's state power can be oppressive, for example, or focus on it being for self can be selfish. But yeah, I think, Mark, you're bringing out a good aspect of flattery because it seems to belong on a spectrum, right? There's the minimal idea of, okay, I'm calling you monarch and that's what makes you monarch. So the social construction. But it can also go to the other extreme of taking someone who is evil and egotistical, genuinely evil, and blowing up his ego even more and creating something, for instance, authoritarian. And that's, I think, interesting in light of 512, where he says that noble consciousness, what they ultimately sacrifice is thought and being for self. They get back universality. And I think this goes towards the idea of identification, right, as well. If I'm a nationalist or identify with some group or, you know, whatever I'm identifying with, I sacrifice being for self in the sense of individuality. And then I can say, oh, I'm an American, or, oh, I'm part of the French nobility, or, oh, I'm in service to the king, or something like that. So that's what noble consciousness sacrifices to state power to produce the monarch. But in 512, we also get the second step where the monarch becomes self-alienated because noble consciousness gets back something in return. And what he gets is wealth. And therefore, in a way, they get back the will of the monarch as well. So the monarch has been lent a will, right? And now it's going to get taken back via wealth.
Let's stop for some ads. I want to talk to you about Gusto. Running a small business is hard. The economy is a lot right now. You can't control interest rates or tariffs, but you can control how effectively your business operates. Automating payroll and HR with Gusto is one of the fastest ways to cut friction and focus on what actually moves the needle. Gusto is online payment and benefit software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. Gusto is used at my day job. I get a notification from Gusto when my money has come in. It is putting together tax information. It is performing direct deposits. Anything else that an employer wants to put in there, like health benefits, commuter benefits, 401k, or that they have to put in there, say, because of the laws that vary from state to state to state, Gusto is going to handle that. Switching to Gusto is very easy. It is one of the first things that my current employer did when he bought the company. Gusto is rated number one on G2's highest satisfaction products list for 2026 and trusted by over 400,000 small businesses. And you don't pay a cent until you run your first payroll. So you can look at all the functionality, get things set up with absolutely no cost. There are no hidden fees and no surprises. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/PEL and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/PEL. One more time, gusto.com/PEL.
Running a small business is tough. When it's time to get a loan, it can feel impossible to find a lender you actually trust. Big banks say no. The internet full of sketchy offers with sky-high rates and fine print you can barely read. Whether you need help covering payroll, managing cash flow, or investing in growth, you deserve better. That's why I recommend the small business marketplace Fundera, powered by NerdWallet. It's a free, easy-to-use platform that lets you compare real financing offers from trusted lenders all in one place. What I like is you don't need perfect credit to get started. No spam, no bait and switch, just personalized options that fit your business needs. And here's the best part. For a limited time, when you visit nerdwallet.com/PEL and fill out the no-obligation form, you'll get VIP treatment and talk with a real person who knows all the ins and outs of small business lending. Don't risk your business on unreliable lenders. Go to nerdwallet.com/PEL to find the funding you deserve. Fundera Inc., NMLS ID number 1240038.
When we started this podcast, it seemed like we had to figure it out all on our own. It was really overwhelming, and every day seemed to introduce a new decision that needed an answer. When you're starting off with something new, it seems like your to-do list keeps growing every day with new tasks, and that list can easily begin to overrun your life. Finding the right tool that not only helps you out, but simplifies everything can be such a game changer. For millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. From household names like Gymshark and Cotopaxi and Heinz to brands just getting started. Get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand's style. Accelerate your efficiency, whether you're uploading new products or trying to improve existing ones. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. Tackle all those important tasks in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics and more. No need to save multiple websites or try to figure out what platform is hosting the tool that you need. Everything is all in one place, making your life easier and your business operations smoother. Start your business today with the industry's best business partner, Shopify, and start hearing. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/PEL. Go to shopify.com/PEL. That's shopify.com/PEL.
How does that functioning of the monarch differ from the emperor? Is it because the whole structure of nobility in this is patronage? And so it's like you flatter, then you get, you know, things from the king, like in the Roman state, that was a different kind of setup? Or why would we think this monarch is different than the Roman monarch?
Well, you know, in 482, you get this atomization of, I'm probably not going to answer your question very well. I'm just looking back at my notes to try to make this a connection, but you have all these dispersed atoms, right? The atomization of the subjects, and it, in their kind of soulless legalistic society where what they have is rights and personhood. Mm-hmm. And all personality in the robust sense gets put into the emperor, the absolute power. So there's a direct correlation here. And then it seems to me that gets broken apart in the emperor's, it becomes a tyrant essentially, and everything functions according to his whim. And so it further denatures the cells of that society. I don't know what happens after that. How do we get the transition into culture from the Roman?
Right. I don't know that it presents, it proceeds as if like this were one political narrative. Like now we have an emperor, but then there's a breakdown. And now through culture, we're building back up to a king. I don't feel like we get something that clear. I feel like I thought that this whole culture section was an elaboration of, you know, we've gotten to a point where power is going to centralize itself, and it can centralize itself, Wes, like you were just saying, as personality, you know, that the emperor just sucks up all the personality. So this is really the point where, just like in the sense perception section, we were saying these indexicals now and this like become generic. You just become person. There's no specific stuff at all. But as culture develops, then we're going to have, you know, the development of these roles, these personalities. So now it's not that you're a doctor or whatever and you give the king your doctorship, like you don't do that, but you give the king your allegiance. So it's more values all pile into one place, not personality. So you're generic, but generic as doctor, not generic as person.
Yeah, hopefully this relates to what you just said, but just to give you the transition in 483 and 484, right? He'll say that alienation from the emperor becomes sort of like an actualization of the self. So this kind of gets at Seth's question, because the noble consciousness is getting back something from the monarch similarly. And then in 484, you get the confrontation between the self and, well, it's a complicated section where he talks about the violence of the liberated elements. But anyway, there's some sort of transition into culture there. And now we're getting this recapitulation. But maybe as we go on, we'll figure out what wealth is recapitulating exactly.
Yeah, it didn't seem like in this Roman emperor phase that there was, of course, you know, there was wealth. You know, that was still a thing. But it was not playing this autonomous role or this mediating role in the same way. You know, once we have the wealth of nations, right, our commentators point out that Hegel was very much aware of that idea. And so you could think that it's not just that the goodness of society is about the goodness of the leader and how well the leader represents the general will of the people, something like that. But as a distinct source of power is distributed wealth, which, you know, the more of that there is around, then the more the general good of society goes up, according to Smith's Invisible Hand. Right. So that's just the setup for, you know, what's going on here.
Yeah. I want to go back to, so I asked the question of Wes, or I asked the question generally, what's different here than what we read 15 pages ago, right? And that probably was an unfair...
It's too complicated a question, but yeah.
It shouldn't be, but...
We do have a mediating term here in the nobility, but yeah.
Correct. Ahead. So I think ultimately, from Hegel's point of view, you know, what's important is how the mediation works and ultimately what is the effect on the self-consciousness or, you know, the self and the alienated other, and what's the, how do they function? So if we look at 513, he says, while therefore the noble consciousness behaves as if it were conforming to the universal power, and this is the, what giving itself up, right? The truth about it is rather that in its service, it retains its own being for self, and that in the genuine renunciation of its personality, it actually sets aside and rends in pieces the universal substance. Okay, I'm not sure about that last part. So if I were to answer my own question using that language, we have a form of service, a form of giving of self in the, you know, Roman context, let's call it, or the state power context, that where the individual does not retain being for self, it's being for other. And what he's saying, what's magic here, what ultimately, I guess, what language makes possible is for you to sacrifice yourself and yet retain being for self.
Noble consciousness, I think he says it retains its own being for self in its service. I think I'm just repeating what you just said. But then alienates itself from its own inner nature. And this is how it's going to become ignoble consciousness, right? So it's now, in a way, at variance with the universal substance, the monarch, state power, right? Instead of just supporting it. And it's at variance in the sense that it's brought universal power under the control of its being for self by way of flattery. So this is all going to get elaborated. What is now just the seed of variance will get elaborated into ultimately into like rebelliousness, for instance.
So similar to the question that Seth just asked, we could ask how is this going to be different than 5 pages ago where
we're never going to get
because you're saying that when you give up yourself, that creates the ignoble consciousness. But that's not what he says here in 513. The ignoble consciousness was the emphasis on wealth. And I'm not going to align myself with the king here. I'm aligning myself with the king. I'm giving all myself to him. And he says, it's clear the specific character, which it was judged to have in comparison with what was called the ignoble consciousness, has disappeared. And with it, the latter too. The ignoble consciousness has achieved its purpose, namely to bring the universal power under the control of being for self. So there is no more ignoble consciousness.
Yeah, I must just be getting that wrong in my notes. I'm reading variance for some reason. Yeah, reading this idea of variance as...
There is something about that you retain your being for self, even when you try to give it all to the king. But that's not the ignoble part. It is something else.
Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking there. But yeah, you know, in 514, we do get... There's this idea of subordination, right? So the monarch is now a subordinated object of being for self.
So he says in 514 and 515 that wealth is something different than wealth has a kind of being for self. It's an object for self-consciousness or for the individual that is actual, not beyond or whatever, but it has a substance, it has an essence, it has a kind of being for self, which state power does not. He says also the naive, inorganic nature of spirit. And he says, essentially, since wealth has a kind of essence, but it's just merely the form, right? Then it isn't quite fully what...
It's one-sided being for self.
Yeah. He says it, therefore, itself requires to be ensouled. And essentially, what it's going to need to be done is it's going to need to be kind of ensouled in that individual, the monarch, right? Or maybe even in the individual, so that the individual can then appropriately be alienated from it and do whatever kind of reflection that it needs to do to come back to its own being for self.
Just to make it clear to listeners, like when we're talking about wealth, the monarch is making the nobles wealthy. The monarch is paying off the nobles in return for flattery. So it's a you scratch my back, I scratch yours. And in 514, right, there's talk of gratitude. So the noble consciousness feels gratitude towards the universal power, which is another name for the monarch, as the benefactor. And that's what helps it preserve its being for self, right? Gratitude apparently is one of these emotions that preserves being for self. And in a way, it makes the universal power something unessential. But then in 515, as Seth, you pointed out, this enjoyment of wealth and the gratitude that comes with it, it is being for self, but it's one-sided and so has no intrinsic being of its own. And it's going to require ensoulment, right? So in other words, we're driven on to the next step of the dialectic by this one-sidedness. And the next step is just for noble consciousness to realize in 516 that it is dependent on this alien thing, wealth, right? To, you know, it's fun for a moment. Oh, look at what's being given to me. Aren't I grateful for it? But then the specter of dependency comes in, dependency on something outside of myself, on something alien that's being given to me.
Yeah, Wes, it was right of you, I think, to try and make this a little more real for the listeners. So like, if you're listening to this, you probably have a job or you did have a job and you sacrificed yourself in some way, shape or form to a company or an organization or whatever. And you did it so that you could make a living, so that you could spend money doing things that you enjoyed, right? And you did it knowingly to some extent. You know, you were like, yeah, I don't love my job. I don't love my boss, but they're the one who makes it possible for me to, and the enjoyment you control. So there's a sense in which you find yourself in the enjoyment aspect, but you're still beholden to this other. And you realize it's kind of like, it's not like you're in some kind of relationship with the company or with wealth, you know, with the money that you're making that's making you whole. You're a dependent, but you're doing it in a certain sense consciously. And it's just, that's the dynamic that's kind of at play here, which is if you're trying to become a fully realized, self-actualized, like find yourself, be at home with yourself, whatever the end goal of the Hegelian dialectic is, you can see how this would not be satisfying. It's just, you know, it's sustainable for a while, but it's not satisfying.
Yeah, this actually had me thinking a lot about my relationship to money and wealth and because I'm also reading a book by Orwell, a novel called Keep the Aspidistra kind of plant. But it's about a guy who wants to be a poet and he hates money and gives up and wealth, is very anti-capitalist and gives up a really good job to become a poet. But then finds out that, you know, well, you kind of need money to live. And that's kind of the, you know, if we wanted to generalize it and kind of relate it, that's kind of the dilemma that's being introduced here. And it showed, you know, it's a problem of dependency more generally where we, in a way, we want to be independent individuals, but we're reliant on others for our individuality. And that this is a repeating theme of the dialectic where even a perceptual object, in a way, must internalize the, something from others in order to be what it is. So we don't get to be what we are, free of all interrelatedness to others, unfortunately. And that's kind of the tragedy that keeps getting worked through over and over again, I think, in this.
Yes, I'm picturing sort of a right-wing Marxism. I mean, because obviously this is part of what influenced Marx, but it's not the proletarian revolution. It's sort of the nobles' revolution in that the nobles in, we want to be nobles. We want to be wealthy. So we're putting ourselves on the side of the king. The king will reward us by giving us, you know, keeping us wealthy. But then there is something horrible and alienating about that. And I don't like being dependent on the king. And so to develop my sense of self and realize I should not be just bowing to the king, that I have this sense of inalienable sense of self, you know, once we've gotten to this point in history that cannot be given up to the king, such that, you know, you develop this rugged individualism, but It's not like the naive, rugged individualism that we have in the West. It is one that recognizes its origins in the social, that you have to go through the period of dependency before you become the rugged individualist. It doesn't work otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, the dependency is a moment that grounds any form of independence we could possibly have. And the fantasy of complete independence, right? That's how you get nationalism and even conspiracy theories, where the people who are conspiratorially minded think in some way they can just make themselves fully independent of reliance on our epistemic dependence on testimonial evidence from others, right? And they have this fantasy that by getting on and looking at YouTube videos that they're doing their own research, quote unquote. Or the nationalist, right, who wants to, or maybe, you know, even libertarians who want to have this fantasy of any independence from institute agencies of the common good. Oh, that's just the nanny state and it makes us too dependent and blah, blah, blah. But they're just in complete denial of their very, very real dependence on those agencies, or our very real dependence on others epistemically and in many other ways. But as we move on, as I look here, I think I understand now why I was thinking about ignoble consciousness, because ultimately it's going to come up again in 516. Well, we've already done that. In 517, we get this elaboration where, you know, despite self-consciousness maintaining its awareness of its independence, and part of how it does so is in the sphere of law, it still is conscious of the fact that it, in a way, it depends on the whims of the monarch. So you get this contrast between, okay, well, there's law, so I'm not entirely dependent on the whims of the monarch. There's an actual system that's independent of everyone. And maybe in a sense, everyone is subject to the law. But the monarch is still the monarch. So it's whatever he wants, the contingencies of his particular personality that I'm dependent upon. So you get this phase of alienation where now my being for self in a way is starting to drift outside of me. And that's where gratitude turns into rebellion at the end of 517. And it's what I'm associating with ignoble consciousness, which is going to come up more explicitly in the following sections.
I feel like that first clause in 517 is really important. Self-consciousness can make abstraction from every particular aspect, right? So even though we said you only recognize your sense of self because your profession, your race, you know, any number of things that might go into that, but you could abstract from any particular aspect of those, that you just need something to identify, but you could say, oh, well, race is not important. What the fuck is that? You could say, I'm a citizen of the world. My status as an American isn't important. You could say, you know, yeah, any particular thing, just not all of them at once, right? Otherwise, you're Buddhist. You know, there's no self left. There's no content left to self.
This is how it retains the recognition and intrinsic validity of itself as an independent being. So, Marcus, you're saying, yeah, I whatever qualities I have, which are universals, I can always abstract from that and say, well, you know, I think it's like saying I'm the substance underneath all those different properties. I'm a numerically distinct independent being. On the other hand, that's the next sentence, as the aspect of that pure actuality, which is its own I, it finds itself outside itself and belongs to another, finds that its personality as such is dependent on the contingent personality of another, which I take to be the monarch, on the accident of a moment, on a caprice, or some utterly unimportant circumstance. I mean, we could broaden this, right? But I think in this case, it becomes the whims of the monarch as we move on, right? So we, in a way, we can abstract to say that we are more than a function of our dependence on another. But on the other hand, we get drawn back into that dependence. And then it seems to make us, you know, to use this phrase, devoid of an essence. And in the end, the only way I can do that, to get beyond that, is to put myself in a state of rebellion. So all identity dissolves away, for the utmost disparity now occupies the scene. What is absolutely essential is now absolutely unessential. Being for self is now external to itself. The pure I has been disrupted. Why do I have in my notes that in 517, gratitude becomes rebellion? Does he say that explicitly?
Maybe you got it. Yeah. The spirit of its gratitude is therefore the feeling of the most profound dejection as well as of extreme rebellion.
Okay, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we get this, yeah, again, a dialectical reversal. Gratitude to rebellion, right? Gratitude for what I'm receiving, which in a way is my identity from the other. But then rebellion was like, well, screw you. I don't want to depend on you for my identity. So, yeah.
Right. We talked when Wes and I were doing the Unhappy Consciousness chapter on Close Reads. We talked a lot about sort of the Nietzschean dynamics at play here in there as here. When you try to bow down, oh, I'm just nothing before you, oh Lord, or in this case, oh King, then that actually ends up being an assertion of your own power, that you were unable to actually give up power. We're just inherently self-asserters, even when we try to abdicate ourselves.
Yeah, and it's self-asserting because this is unhappy consciousness, yeah.
Right, part of it is like, oh, look at me, I'm helping you out. What power I have, I'm participating in this whole thing. So just by, right, the heroism of service, of flattery, I'm raising myself to your level when I try to bow down before you and be on your team.
It's very passive aggressive. Yeah. I mean, the monarch, right, depends on the nobles. If they don't name him as such, then he can't be such. And then the nobles in turn depend on the monarch. So each can say, well, I'm the principal mover here.
Right. What's added here, there's not necessarily in your bowing down to God or something, a sense of dissatisfaction. Like, oh, I don't actually like being abject. This sucks. I mean, you could imagine that a lot of would-be saints would feel that way. But here it is like, well, what am I getting out of this? I'm getting wealth. Well, what is wealth? Is something transitory. You know, I can do all this sort of stoic. What the hell am I doing with my life that I'm putting it in such shallow things as wealth and power? So my very being rebels against that and wants to assert itself as, you know, a full humanity that is not subject to these stupid worldly things.
And thus in 519, noble consciousness and ignoble consciousness become the same. So since then, the condition of this consciousness is linked with this absolute disruption. The distinction within its spirit of being noble as opposed to ignoble falls away, and both are the same. So the corresponding transition in the monarch is from beneficence to arrogance. And I'll let one of you elaborate on that.
Well, I sort of want to go back to something that was hanging out from 515, which was the comparable evolution of wealth in the same way that state power was. So in our last discussion, state power, you know, the nobles are trying to assert state power. They're trying to be on the side. But they said, well, oh, but the state power does not yet have a will. It hasn't come together as the monarch yet, which is sort of hard for me to imagine, like what that intermediate stage is before it has a will.
Well, lords and vassals. So the will is dispersed among in feudal society before
okay.
We get a concentration and yeah, and single monarch.
So here also wealth was something, I guess, that was distributed a la Adam Smith's. There's wealth all over the place. Even when we're all giving our taxes and accolades and calling the king, and so the king, in effect, gets control of all of our wealth, but then sort of at the deal of, but he's going to use his largesse to pass it out, still wealth requires to be ensouled in a way that I think is supposed to be distinct from the monarch. So it could just be the monarch qua state power has a will, but the monarch qua the spirit of giving, capital letters, capital S, capital G, has not yet been ensouled. And I'm not sure I understand this move. If as you guys were interpreting it, it's just the monarch who is the one who has the wealth. Well, he already has a will. He doesn't need to be ensouled again.
Yeah, he did get his will in a previous section, right?
Yeah, so this is supposed to be something else that is comparable. Oz,
he's already been handed his certificate of having a will. So what's going on now?
Mark, this gets back to what I was mentioning earlier, where I feel like I need a better understanding of kind of all this terminology, because it seems like there's an ideal way, like the ideal state or the end state or whatever is going to be, you know, some form of being for self, substance, actual, you know, all these terms are going to come into play. And, you know, we've talked about how it's the other that self-consciousness is going to need to be alienated from in order to get to that state also has to have, or also will have to have, all of those characteristics as well. And it feels like each iteration of this development, we're like coming across where, okay, we've got another, but it's not actual. It doesn't have essence, isn't a substance. It's just a notion. It's pure insight, right? Which has no actuality or whatever. And you go back and forth. And then sometimes things have actuality, but they don't have being for self or yada, yada, and yada, yada. And that's the part where, you know, I think if we just, we can kind of like try to figure out very specifically here what the monarch has or doesn't have. But, you know, ultimately where we're at is we have an alienated self-consciousness, an alienated individual that is trying to recognize, is trying to determine something, is trying to move forward out of this alienation. And either the thing that it's alienated against isn't sufficiently real, powerful, solid, you know, has the identity that's necessary to do that, or it's just a stage on the way that we still have a long way to go.
Well, let's let that be the last word of part one here, and maybe we can return to this and tackle the rest of this part of the text with a little clearer. We'll take another swipe at this question at the beginning of part two, let's say that. If you want to get part two right now or very, very soon, you need to support us through our website or through Patreon. You can learn how to do those things at partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. You will get an ad-free experience with those. Also, if you're using the Apple Podcast app and just want to push subscribe, you will also get the ad-free experience, but you will not get the early episodes. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.